Hey, it's Mae Whitman, and I play Frankie in the new Realm podcast, The Sisters. The Sisters is about a museum curator of medical oddities who investigates the origins of a mutated skeleton with two layers of bones. Soon, she uncovers an extraordinary mystery that connects her present with one family's tragic past in hauntingly dangerous ways. Listen to The Sisters wherever you get your podcasts.
Beyond and hello, everyone. My name is Jonathan Dornbush, and this is Podcast Beyond, IGN's weekly PlayStation show covering all the latest and greatest in the world of PlayStation, nothing else whatsoever. And so, of course, we're going to dive immediately into spoilers for the season finale of Loki Season 1. Of course, to do all of that, I'm joined by Brian Altano.
We're not going to spoil Loki Season 1, don't worry.
I haven't watched it yet, so we're not going to spoil it. And Max Scoville.
The only Loki we're going to be spoiling is your dog, Jonathan, because he's a very good boy and he deserves some begging strips.
He does, but he's also not in the room, so I can't pull him out for this poorly timed joke on my part. Of course, we are going to be jumping into a lot of PlayStation news. I do want to start off by asking both of you, and I guess the audience at large, I just really want to, of course, this week, Lucy O'Brien isn't on the show, and she won't be next week as well. She's off on vacation in her native lands, and so we won't have her on the show for the next couple weeks, but we'll have her back as soon as we can. I want to think of something that we can do that when she comes back, we have like we pretend like there is this ongoing joke or thread through the show that Ooh, isn't like that. Real. Like, it's not a real ongoing thread, but we just pretend like it's a thing that has popped up these last couple weeks, and we refer back to it like how Black Widow and Hawkeye would always be like, remember that time in Budapest? But we don't actually show Budapest.
Budapest,
excuse me. Yeah, someone has seen Marvel's Black Widow. Anyway, please write into us with your thoughts.
This is on a PlayStation show, Jonathan. What kind of pranks would we do? I don't know. Like,
I don't know. That's the thing. I just want to do it. I don't know what the prank should be. I want to do something.
I got it. Ooh, a bird flew into Brian's room and was knocking over toys.
Constantly. Ooh. It's still there too, and I haven't found it.
I like it. We'll do bird watch with you, a literal bird watch with you when she comes back then.
Or you know what we could do? How about we do a section called the clap, where we all clap for something that Sony did that week. We go, now it's time for the clap, and we go, ooh, good job, Sony.
Like, yeah, yes.
You had a great tweet the other day.
That's good.
And then we all do this. We just go 1, 2, 3, clap. That's it.
There we go.
That's good. The PlayStation clap. I love it.
Yeah.
Clap.
And we'll just keep doing it. And Lucy will be like, what happened?
I love it.
When did this start?
When I worked at a coffee shop, we told this one girl that there was a new policy. Like, she worked the mid shift. I worked opening shift. And she showed up and we're like, hey, there's a new policy. It came down from corporate. We all have to say thanks a latte when someone orders a latte. And we had her going. She did it the whole day.
Oh, man. That's really good. I was going to play a prank like that on Alana one day in the office way back when. But I thought of the joke in my head and thought it was so funny that I started laughing to myself before I could even say the joke. It was going to be about what we do on President's Day in the United States and how we all dress up like different presidents and have to only speak in quotes by them.
Why don't we do that?
That's how we celebrate the holiday.
Well, while we're on the subject of not talking about PlayStation for the next 30 seconds, we did try to convince Alana at one point in Las Vegas that Americans at the end of a big meal clap. And so we all went out to like a big hearty lunch restaurant. And then at the end, we were like, yeah.
Well, that started when like you guys were in the plane and it landed and then somebody started clapping, right? Wasn't that it?
Yeah. Which is weird.
Which is weird. I feel like clapping in movie theaters on an airplane's like I sort of get it, but it's also it's always awkward because it's always sort of starts with like one person and everyone else is like, oh, some people are like, I guess I'll clap. But other people are like, why are they clapping? No one should be clapping right now.
Like, I've been to movies where people clap at the end, and I've been on flights where people clap at the end. But in like the 90s, they used to show movies on flights, but no one would ever clap at the end, which is weird. That's like a two, you know, passing of the ship.
Well, that'd be weird. It's because everyone would be sleeping and everyone would just start clapping in the middle. They'd be like, what happened? It'd be like, I finished Now You See Me Part 2.
Well, sorry, go ahead, Brian.
I was going to say, is there any PlayStation news?
Well, no, I was going to say, of course, as we all know, you also always clap at the end of every video game you finish when the director's name shows up.
Yeah, PlayStation's the clap.
That will be doubly true with the upcoming director's cuts that we have coming out in the world of PlayStation, specifically the Death Stranding director's cut and the Ghost of Tsushima director's cut. But as we learned earlier this week, even one of those directors, Hideo Kojima, is not a fan of the phrase. In some tweets that I believe someone had said they have now been deleted, but I'm going to double check and see if that's actually true. But anyway, in some tweets, Kojima was talking about how a director's cut in a movie is an additional edit to a shortened version that was either released reluctantly because the director did not have the right to edit it or because the running time had to be shortened. He then followed up and said, in the game, it is not what was cut, but what was additionally produced that was included. So in my opinion, I don't like to call it a director's cut. This is a little bit of a weird moment for a naming convention, and I kind of want to talk to both of you about it, because obviously we also, I think all three of us, you know, are very into movie releases and tracking the production of movies and all these things, and like the term director's cut does really mean something very specific to that world. And so bringing it over into the game world, you would think, oh, it is the stuff that was left on the cutting room floor that they couldn't get into production. But both this and in the Ghost of Tsushima blog post, where they revealed all the content that was planned, they talked about a lot of this was made in feedback to people had after the game launched. So right. What we're dealing with here are essentially two deluxe editions of a game, or, you know, the final mix version. That's the thing that Kingdom Hearts use a lot. It's a thing that like has existed in games, but using the term director's cut has started to draw some ire from people and also some confusion from some of the directors making the games. So I kind of wanted to start off by just generally asking how you feel about the use of the director's cut naming convention, and if you feel like it's going to be a problem or it's just something that they kind of think is some snazzy marketing term. And Brian, I'll start with you on how you feel.
Yeah. Well, we got into this a little bit last week, and it was kind of interesting that this quote from Kojima came out via his Twitter just a few days later, because last week we talked about Sony is probably using this term because they want to sort of play up the sort of cinematic importance of their games, right? They want to make these big sort of like blockbuster tentpole movie, you know, very sort of narrative driven games with directors and, you know, with all the feel of like a big movie release, but as a video game, right? These are stories that they're trying to tell. That's been a big part of what they're doing. That said, I think that like the director's cut thing has never always made a ton of sense, but if there's one thing that the Snyder cut accomplished, is that that sort of changed the terminology forever. Like, there was such a sort of weird back and forth bad blood on how like Zack Snyder was able to go back in and finish his film from acclaimed pervert Joss Whedon, who went basically
not acclaimed for the perversion, just to be
no. For I guess like people liked his stuff before he was a pervert, or he was a pervert the whole time, whatever. Maybe you still like his stuff. That's on you, not me. Never cared. But so I think that like Zack Snyder famously going back in, finishing his movie, and then HBO being like, we're going to put all of our sort of like promotional strength behind this, use it as a traffic subscription driver. Like, there was a sort of redemption arc story there. This is not really what's happening with games that were completed, got nominated for Game of the Year, you know, sold a bunch of copies, critically acclaimed for the most part, reached a bunch of fans and stuff like that. These are not people that were locked out of the studio, that weren't allowed, you know, the editing room, weren't allowed to finish their stuff. This is people going back in and adding more things to it. And like Max said last week, you know, the Game of the Year moniker is kind of tacky, and I totally agree with that. And so I'm glad they're finding something, but I do think that there's like, I think there should be a different terminology here, because if we're two games in and both of them are coming from directors that had full creative control that are now going back in to add more stuff, and one of which is publicly saying, hey, I don't really agree with this phrase, then I think we need a new naming convention here.
Yeah, it's obviously something that based on this comment to me, and based on it being used across different, like both internal first party and first party published games, it's very clearly a thing PlayStation wants to put forward. And I agree with you, like it helps convey that sense of them of like very cinematic game experiences, and that's really what they want their mark to be, and games that can sort of transcend the idea of just something you're playing, but some artistic medium that rises above necessarily.
Right. I saw Jeff Grobe from GameSpeed tweeted out that like Kojima only put that tweet out to so he could tell his friends, you know, Nicholas Winding Refn and Del Toro that he knew what a director's cut was. It's like super funny to me. That's such a good joke. Good work,
I
Jeff.
Love that. But yeah, it's a strange moment for the term because yeah, I agree and yeah, Max, as you had said, like game of the year is a silly term to use at this point, especially because probably any game that wants to use game of the year can find a website that called them game of the year.
Right.
It doesn't necessarily mean a certain thing anymore.
Well, you could be nominated for like best music and then that's still technically a game of the year nominee. So, you know, it's sort of like Academy Award winning movie Suicide Squad.
That's very true. But Max, how do you feel about the usage right now?
I think it's ironic that the person who has a problem with the term director's cut is the director. Like mm-hmm. maybe they should have floated that by the actual directors before being like, this is their version of it. Yeah, I mean, the thing here is that this is software and it's applying a sort of, you know, cinematic naming convention to it, which doesn't always work. It's kind of weird if you look at like what, like software by design has like iterations. Like it's very normal for there to be like, oh, it's version 2.0 or it's the upgraded version or whatever. Like that's super normal for games because they are software and they are easy to, not easy to patch, but they're more easier to patch than like, you know, an album or a movie or something like that. Conversely, when we talk about what a remaster is, I feel like it's almost more akin to like a shot for shot remake. Cause you look at what like a remaster is in terms of music and it's going in and like kind of tweaking the levels and like adjusting the, you know, maybe it's taking the original tapes and like, you know, running through again, but you know, they're not recreating the entire album from the ground up. Whereas we have this whole conversation about like what constitutes a remaster versus a remake versus a reboot in terms of games nowadays. I don't know. The director's cut seems like they maybe should have workshopped that a little bit more, especially if, you know, is this the second time they've used it?
It's these two games. So yeah, it'll be Ghosts and Death Stranding that are getting that moniker.
And they're probably ramping up to use it for The Last of Us
too. Oh, totally. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It's odd. It's also, I mean, it's if it's a version that has additional stuff that was made for the sake of that is more like the kind of Snyder Cut George Lucas special edition approach where you're like, I'm gonna go in and add a bunch of things and shuffle things around and change stuff up. But it's, I don't know, it's just, it's sort of funny to think about because it's a weird name. It's very funny to me that Kojima was like, I don't like this name, me the director, like this is not like
well, because that game was I'm stunned at the way that game came together because that was a guy that basically very publicly left a company he worked with for a long time over creative differences. Sort of famously was unable to finish his last game. I saw some trailers getting kicked around for MGS5 the other day, and there's just all this stuff in it that were just not in the final game, which is interesting. You know, that game sort of didn't really have an ending. But then he went on with this awesome redemption story, and Sony funded, you know, the development, and he created this brand new studio. He had all those people in the hallway with the statue. Like, he had total creative control, and that's really cool. And I think on the movie side, a thing you see a lot is extended edition, right? Or like the extended cut. And that's usually when they add extra scenes. I'm actually surprised that they haven't used that phrasing for video games because like gamers love knowing that they're getting more of a game. They love to know how long of a game they're getting for the, you know, perceived value, how many hours are being tacked on. The Ghost of Tsushima stuff that's adding an entire new island is rumored to add somewhere between like 15 and 20 hours of new content. And it's odd that that isn't just being called like DLC or an expansion or anything like that, but it's all just being rolled into this director's cut thing.
So where in the case of Ghost of Tsushima, I feel like that naming works on two levels because they had the whole Kurosawa mode, and then it's also a game about cutting stuff, so it's almost like a wink and a nod to play on words. But yeah, I don't know,
I can't wait for the Fruit Ninja director's cut then. I will say, so a thing I am there are those rumors going around from a alleged ghost tester. I would say from things I've heard, don't put too much stock into all of that. But nonetheless, I do think we're going to get a pretty sizable chunk of new content here.
Was that a rumor? The 15 hours of extra content?
There's been a Reddit leaker who was a tester on the game who has all this info about it, but I wouldn't put too much stock in it at the moment.
Well, my uncle works at Nintendo, and he said that he shouldn't play this game because it doesn't have Waluigi in it.
You know, it's weird that Sony's applying this term across the board. Like, it's kind of, we all know what it is in terms of movies, but at the same time, movies frequently use varied terms for that. Like, we have obviously the Snyder Cut or the, you know, Mad Max Black and Chrome Edition or whatever. Even looking at like the Alien box set is like Alien Director's Cut, Aliens Director's Cut, Alien 3 Workprint / Assembly Cut, Alien Resurrection with additional footage. Like, it's not even like across the board. Like, Blade Runner infamously put out a director's cut in the 90s. It was based on what like Ridley Scott's notes were, but they didn't really actually go in and mess with too much. And so when Ridley Scott actually got his hands on it, he made the final cut, which I think a lot of people are like, "Ooh, director's cut, that seems definitive." And then, you know, they go on and watch the final cut. It's, I don't know. I guess what's reassuring is that it's a messy topic regardless of the medium.
Right. Yeah. I was going to bring up the Blade Runner thing. You're right. Because there's still to this day when people go, "Oh, Blade Runner, I've never seen it," which, you know, please fix that. People are always like, "Which versions should I watch?" And there was a debate for a while about which version you should watch. Like, and I think video games don't really have that, right? Because like, if you have the choice between the director's cut of Death Stranding and you know, the launch edition or whatever, like, you're going to tell people to get the one that has more content, because I don't think it's necessarily messing with the pacing. Whereas like, I've heard people debate which version of Majora's Mask or Shadow of the Colossus should I play, because these make sort of aesthetic changes in their remastered form that is sort of much of the chagrin of some, you know, diehards and purists.
Yeah, these two in particular, as you were saying with Death Stranding and Ghost as well, where it's like, hey, we all know how fun and engaging it is to just explore that world and go around it. And here's going to be a version that lets you do that in a brand new environment as well. Like, in addition, it's kind of like, there's no reason you would say, no, only stick with the base game at that point. Why, unless the new island is awful, which I'm not expecting based on everything they've put out, like, you would always tell people to go for the next one. And also, Max, to your point of like, the term already being kind of a mess, as you were both saying with the Snyder cut, it's like, well, yeah, he went, like, he had a lot of footage, sure, but then also went and shot, you know, tens of millions of dollars more to add to it as well. So it's, yeah, like, the director's cut, the blank person's cut, is kind of always in a strange place. It's just in a weird position right now with, I think, PlayStation wanting this to clearly be a thing, and one of the first directors that they have on board being like, I don't get the naming here. It's just a weird moment for it. But as you said, I imagine we'll continue to see this unless these versions do terribly in sales, which I'm not expecting to. We'll probably get more director's cuts. As you were saying, excuse me, The Last of Us Part Two feels like the next obvious candidate. I don't know where else they would go from there, like in the immediate back catalog, because I feel like all focus is on the next God of War and Horizon Forbidden West. So I don't feel like they're going to put new content into those games at this point.
But, right. Yeah, I mean, never say never, right? I wasn't expecting this much new stuff being added to Ghost of Tsushima. I figured they would do sort of like a standalone, you know, and sort of what Naughty Dog does, which is make like an 8-hour kind of spin-off game or DLC, or just save it all for a sequel.
Yeah. I mean, they had something similar with that with First Light for Infamous at the beginning of the PS4 generation. So it's cool to see them continuing to support things. As long as it means more PlayStation releases, like, that's great with me. A chance to revisit these games I love. So I'll certainly.
The first cell phone was demonstrated in 1973 by Martin Cooper. You know what wasn't demonstrated? Shared plans. Over 50 years later, you can save on one line thanks to Visible. When you switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless Visible, you can get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees. No, really. You can look around for them. They're not there. Switch now at Visible.com. Save on wireless without the hassle. Switch to Visible today and save at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com. This episode of Podcast Beyond is brought to you by NordVPN, a great way to protect yourself online while also improving your overall experience while enjoying cyberspace. Are you tired of streaming shows, movies, or sporting events being unavailable in your region due to draconian restrictions that are based on completely arbitrary geographical boundaries in physical meat space? Well, switch your virtual location to a place where that's no longer an issue. The same goes for shopping. You can get the best possible deal on subscriptions, flights, hotels, and other goods and services like that from websites that like to play favorites with certain territories and currencies. Meanwhile, encrypted traffic protects your data from hackers, viruses, malware, phishing sites, and other harmful hitchhikers of the information superhighway. Though really, it's more of an information autobahn because there is no speed limit with NordVPN. It is the fastest VPN in the world, so there won't be any buffering or lagging, and it'll stop your ISP from throttling your bandwidth. Isn't that nice? One NordVPN account can be used across 6 devices, which is great. My wife has been using our account to watch all sorts of awful British reality TV shows that aren't available here, like Argument Island or Half Naked Idiots Fall in Love, and everyone's favorite, The Worst People Just Got Married. Let's hear them talk about it. Shows that are so bad they're blocked in our part of the world for our own good, but luckily, NordVPN allows her to trick the internet into thinking she's in the UK, so she and her awful friends can shriek and howl and cackle at the TV while I'm trying to relax. I've been using my VPN too. You know what I've been using it for? None of your business. Yep, that's right. And thanks to NordVPN, my data is safely encrypted, all bundled up in a weighted security blanket of incomprehensibly complex math problems, and nobody can tell what it's doing under there. Data, you do your thing. I'll leave you alone. 1 month of NordVPN coverage costs less than a cup of coffee. Coffee can't protect you from cybercriminals unless you throw it at them or pour it on their computers, and you'll probably get in trouble for doing that. So get NordVPN instead. To get the best possible discount off your NordVPN plan, go to nordvpn.com/pobeyond. That link will also give you 4 extra months on the 2-year plan. There's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Again, that is nordvpn.com/pobeyond. And now, back to the show.
Take it. Though, in terms of how those affect the rest of the lineup, I'm going to switch just a little bit in the run of show. We know Ghost of Tsushima and the Death Stranding Director's Cut are coming later this year, August and September. A PS5 exclusive, console exclusive we were expecting this year, Ghostwire Tokyo, has been delayed to early 2022 in order to protect the health of those working on the game. A statement from the Tango and Ghostwire Twitter account said, "We've made the decision to delay the launch of Ghostwire Tokyo to early 2022. We want to get the game in your hands as soon as possible so you can experience the unforgettable version of a haunted Tokyo that we've been hard at work building. At the same time, we're also focused on protecting the health of everyone at Tango. Our new release window will give us time to bring the world of Ghostwire to life as we've always envisioned it. Thank you for being patient as we work to bring you an experience unlike anything else we've ever made. We can't wait to show you more in the coming months." This, I want to ask both of you, but at least for me, this doesn't totally surprise me because we've seen so little of this game. Like, since the launch trailers last year, the reveal trailers, excuse me, we've really gotten nothing about this game. So it doesn't shock me that they needed more of the time. That said, I'm also glad that this comment, in a continuing trend that we've seen, does address the well-being of the developers. Obviously, this is an official corporate statement. Like, you can only take so much of face value. But the fact that these statements have, like, there's been a recent trend of them continuing to mention the health of the developers. We saw this with God of War's delays too. At least I appreciate that that's in there because it does hold them a little bit more accountable, because then if we get stories of, oh, but actually we're working them to the bone even worse because of the delay, like, that begins to create a very troubling narrative for these studios. So I like that it puts a little bit of accountability there. But in terms of its delay, Brian, I'll start with you. Does this come as much of a shock to you?
No, not exactly. I do wonder sort of what the exclusivity window on this remains. I remember reading the fine print in the State of Play the other day about Deathloop basically said, you know, coming to Xbox a year later. So I don't know if this also delays whatever sort of window that happens there. But yeah, I'm fine for the studio taking its time. I never really feel like I'm, you know, short on new games to play. To what you were mentioning earlier about sort of the crunch culture evolving and changing, I think that's one of the best things that can happen. I know every time we bring this up, people are like, well, my job's hard too. And like, you know, with that, we should fix that as well. But if you flash back to sort of Rise Son of Rome, right? One of the launch titles for the last Xbox, the studio at the time sort of famously tweeted out, "Hey, we've ordered like 600 pizzas to keep everybody full while they're home working late." And a bunch of people at the time, they thought like that was a cute thing to say. And a bunch of people were like, that's not good. You shouldn't be doing that. I was reading a piece about Retro the other day. And everyone loves them, right? Like, when you think about Metroid Prime and Donkey Kong and stuff like that, people are like, wow, what a great studio. They're under Nintendo. You don't really hear about crunch from them a lot. Development diaries through them showed that they were crunching like crazy through Metroid Prime. And it's one of the most beloved games. Like, this was such a part of a video game development culture for so long, and to see that slowly change by through the pandemic and through other public means, you know, people like Jason Trier writing books about it and stuff like that. I think all of that is bringing awareness to a problem that is happening in video games. It's also happening elsewhere. It happens in movies, but with, you know, sort of the way unions work, the way, you know, people are under contract, they have to work per hour, they have to get specific breaks and times and stuff like that. The culture seems a little bit different there, although a lot of people sort of have been head down in the editing room working on things for years and you don't really hear about it. But hopefully this is something that changes. None of these things sort of have to come out, you know, this day and this second, that we need to demand that people don't see their families and friends and their, you know, children, and they're lacking their, you know, ignoring their personal health and hygiene just to, you know, animate doors in a fake Tokyo. So take your time, do your thing. We'll be here when you're ready.
Yeah, yeah, the other thing is, like, we talk a lot about sort of like crunch culture being an old problem. It's just now being addressed, which it is in a certain degree. But I imagine it's actually been getting worse gradually, in the same way that, like, you know, video games have stayed the price of $60, but they've quadrupled in resolution, and that's just right. That's just visually, like, there's so many new components and so many moving parts, and they're, you know, these infinitely complex, like massive. Pieces of software, and it's I imagine that there's old habits that some studios have of being like, we should be able to turn a game around in 3 years, which was probably true 10 years ago, but now if you're you know, dealing with that many more moving parts, and you're developing for, instead of, I don't know, putting a game on disk for two systems, putting it on five different variations of two systems digitally and on disk, and then maybe having to patch stuff and then deal with whatever online components. I mean, you read about, like, you know, Atari development, and they would have like one or two dudes would make one game in 4 months.
Right.
And it would come out for one system. And, like, obviously that, you know, the game would look like it would be like four blocks bumping into each other. But, like, you know, things scale. Like, now you look at something like, you know, Assassin's Creed Odyssey or Valhalla, that one. I mean, really, any of them. They're huge. They're staggeringly large, and that's from like a massive global, you know, quadruple A studio that has been doing this on such a consistent level. I mean, maybe the reason we're seeing Assassin's Creed games go from being a yearly release to a, you know, every 2 years release is because to adjust for this. You know, like, you know, we've seen games that get horribly rushed, and I guess this is sort of the flip side of crunch culture and delays, is that, like, it's what a video game is sort of a moving target. And, you know, you look at what games were 10 years ago, and it's a different, like, it's a different ecosystem. Like, they're trying to do different stuff, and expectations are a totally different thing. And that's without the giant monkey wrench that is working remotely during a pandemic.
Yeah. Well, and even just to use the example that you were going with there with Assassin's Creed, their production pipeline is changing even more because of that recently confirmed Infinity project that I believe Trier had broken the news about, and then Ubisoft had acknowledged, of essentially a platform-based future for Assassin's Creed going forward. And even something that, to me, I think of as a long-standing single-player, robust, like, action adventure campaign with open world, obviously, but as one of those things, is suddenly becoming more and more of a live service, and the past few games have been leaning that way. But the pure nature of, like, live service games also just completely throws that all for a wrench. There was I don't know if you guys saw, but Apex Legends was hacked over the July 4th weekend, and with this campaign to fix Titanfall, it was this whole big thing. But one of the devs tweeted about, like, hey, because that hack was happening, I was playing with, like, my newborn nephew and had to hand him back to his parents so I could go work on fixing this patch over a holiday weekend. Like, that has completely changed. Like, all of that just so completely changes the way game development happens beyond the mystery that it already was for so many of us.
Right. And the other side of that conversation was sort of consumers being like, I paid money to access content here, and I have my first sort of few days off in a while. Yep. And I wanted to, and so there was an expectation on both sides. And I don't think that, like, the toxicity doesn't solve anything, obviously. Anyone sending death threats and everybody can in a space. But the Sorry. But I think that like that there is definitely like the consumer is also saying like, hey, I paid to access some of this stuff. How do I access it? And it just sucks for everybody all around. But like Max said, these are massively scaled new projects that are only growing bigger and bigger. They are dealing with so many more things. Like the four guys making the four block bumping game on Atari didn't have to like figure out how does this play through, you know, the Amazon Luna cloud service or anything like that. Like, you know, what about people trying to remote play this from their downstairs living rooms? There's a lot more things, you know, that take into account now. And with all of that sort of convenience of us being consumers to be able to access our games in different ways, play them on different platforms, you know, play them through the cloud or remotely or whatever it is, becomes more work and more testing and more things involved. And so I don't really know what the solution is there, right? Because there's always going to be something. We were just covering a story today about Activision asked, like this hacker was basically just like, I have the most nefarious Call of Duty Warzone hack ever made, and it's undetectable and unstoppable. And he put up videos and they were like, please, please don't do that. Like, please don't do that. And he was like, all right, I won't. But like, that's again, it's sort of, they've banned 500,000 hackers in that game already. So it's like, you know, while one evil was killed, another will rise. Like it's always going to come from somewhere. So yeah, don't know what the solution is. Games are big and crazy now, and there's going to have to be a little bit of patience across the board from everybody involved.
It is a miracle that any game ever gets made whatsoever and works because of all the incredible moving parts in it. And so, yeah, please, you know, with Ghostwire, with any of the games that get delayed, please let the developers be, let them work at the pace they need to live healthy, normal lives as well. There are, I would go out on a limb and say you probably have plenty of games that have come out that someone has told you is amazing that you probably haven't played. I myself have about 700 of those, so I can assume everyone out there has at least a couple. Moving on from there, just briefly want to mention a couple other pieces of news. We're going to be getting a bunch of Persona announcements for the anniversary of the franchise. I personally can't wait. I will, of course, wait until those announcements actually happen, and I hopefully will get Andrew Goldfarb to yell either on a voicemail or something to be able to be on the show about them, whatever they may be. A Gran Turismo 7 beta has allegedly leaked. There is a experience PlayStation website that Sony has that basically people were able to sign up for a beta by putting in a placeholder download code. Of course, this beta is not officially announced, but it's always good to see some signs of life for Gran Turismo 7 as we wait for more news on that one. But that was, of course, delayed into next year. So we'll wait to see if there's another sort of state of play that an announcement for a beta like this might come through. Mm-hmm. We also got news that Final Fantasy XIV, which of course is playable on PS4 and PS5, is so popular that Square had to stop selling it digitally for a little bit, which I really enjoyed as just an amusing aside, because I just don't think that ever really happens with digital sales.
Can you please explain that to me? So were they worried about server stress?
So I think it was partially server stress, because at least like, so the way it works is you can obviously choose which server you're on and which server you're choosing to play Final Fantasy on, and that will allow you to be with certain players. So like I was playing with a few people from my streaming community, and so we waited a little bit to all get on the same server, and it took like my girlfriend was playing a lot as well to get on the same server. She waited I think like 2 or 3 hours, and this was months ago, this was when it first came to PS5, but she was waiting and just refreshing every like 10 minutes for like 2 to 3 hours to get on that server. Its space is just limited to a certain extent. And so I think to avoid server stress, to avoid too much happening, because they have just seen such an influx of players over the last few months, I think they just needed to pause sales for a little bit to be able to, you know, catch right up with everything.
It's a good problem to have, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
definitely better than the reverse.
Yeah. I mean, like we've read the opposite story where like online games have to populate their servers with bots just to get enough people to make matchmaking possible for like a simple, you know, player count. So this is I mean, it's also Square Enix is like sort of famously overshot when it comes to sales expectations with games. You know, like they're always like, we hit 6 million instead of 7 million and we underperformed. And you're like, what? That's a lot of millions, though. So this is cool. Like, hopefully they can figure out how to get more people there. Like, it's kind of awesome.
Yeah, it apparently it was over the weekend, I believe, that the wait list essentially had, been stalled and you couldn't get through it. When we had checked it this week, Matt Kim on our news team had checked it. It seemed to have resumed normal function, so it seems people are able to get in. But it has very popular specific servers as well. So depending on where people were trying to get into, that could have likely mm-hmm. affected it as well. And then last on the news doc, I just wanted to mention, of course, Maneater is getting DLC.
Yeah.
I don't think I put this on here, but I also am very excited.
I put that on there because okay, I know you and I both platinum that game recently.
That
game is awesome. I've talked about this before. Max and I did a Let's Play for it. That's super fun that you can dig up. It's a just open world shark game narrated by Chris Parnell of SNL fame. It's very goofy. It's very over the top, but it also has this like kind of weird undercurrent, no pun intended, sort of thematic plot line about sort of anti-eco-terrorism. This is like a deeply disturbed and disgusting ocean full of wretched humans dumping toxins in and still swimming around. And this shark, for a number of reasons, gets revenge on all of them. And you basically go around. I love that there's a SpongeBob Easter egg. Goes around hunting down all these poachers, trappers, and just nefarious, awful people who are out at sea trying to kill you and trying to disturb the environment. And it's just so much fun. And so they're adding basically this entire new area. They're upping the level cap. They're adding new sort of armor sets. And what's cool about this is like you get different armor sets that are kind of like a fin and teeth. You can get like electric set or bone set or whatever you want, the shadow set. And they're all super, super fun to play with. I just like basically 100% of this game recently. It's on Game Pass if you're looking for something to play there. I believe it was on PlayStation Plus at some point.
It was, right. End of last year.
Yeah. And it also recently got a next gen patches and stuff like that. So it looks and plays very well. It's beautiful. Super, super fun game. Very idiotic. It's not the deepest thing in the world. Again, no pun intended. But I won't say the gameplay is shallow, but
no,
please play Maneater. And if not, just wait for the DLC because it's going to be really fun.
I really appreciate that this is a game where you play as a shark, not mm-hmm. like a guy who's a shark theme or so. Like, I feel like so much of the time they're like, it's a game where you play as an animal who has humanoid characteristics. I mean, this obviously the shark can jump and kick and stuff, but like the fact that they pretty much designed an entire control scheme for like a shark body is such a novelty to me because, mm-hmm. you know, the sort of, I don't know, how many games do you play as a person with arms and legs who runs around and jumps and stuff? It's like pretty, you know, it's kind of played out. I do that every day. I'd like to be a shark for a change.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of fun, as Brian was saying. I also like it for like its length. It is a, you know, 20 hour RPG, which is wonderful. And so you're constantly getting that hit of aggression or progression, also aggression because you're a shark. But the progression of it is just kind of constant. You're getting to either do silly stuff like flopping on a beach and attacking humans or explore underwater. There's a lot of collectibles and stuff. And yeah, the DLC Truth Quest will launch on August 31st. And this plays into the whole fact that like, the game that you're playing is also a reality TV show called Maneater. That is sort of the overarching thing related to Chris Parnell's lines and everything. And so I think mm-hmm. the world has been shown the true nature of this port and everything going on. And so the conspiracy theories only get crazier from there.
It's got that wonderful GTA thing where you sort of like rack up the kills and all of a sudden, you know, more and more crazy things start coming in. And I believe the DLC is bringing in like helicopters and stuff like that. The base game had these sort of like the end game had like these sonar boats that could like send electrical waves out underwater. It's just so much fun. This game is also responsible. Well, I'm responsible for because I'm stupid. But one of the dumbest things I've ever asked in a like sort of trade show interview was Max and I were interviewing the developers and I was like, there's all these buildings everywhere, can the shark go in them? And they were like, no, he's a shark.
See, I think that should be DLC, like, because he can go up on the beach and flop around a little bit. What if he evolves lungs and he just goes up and he can't like walk or run, he just has to flop like that,
like just flop up like 50 yeah. feet to stare.
That'd be great.
Flopping the shark along the sand
office in shark
is mm-hmm. so fun. Oh my god, office
it's
shark.
So funny. I mean, yeah,
they need something for Maneater too.
Why they give him Elton John glasses? What's going on here? This looks great.
Oh, there's the dance sequence. You don't know.
Oh, good. Yeah.
There isn't, but you could believe there would be in this game. Yeah, it's a really a lot of fun. I can't recommend it enough. It is definitely, as Brian said, a little bit shallow, but nonetheless, mm-hmm. it's a really fun time and a relatively easy platinum for those who care.
Mm-hmm. You called it like a good podcast game, which I totally agree with.
Yeah, it's a lot, like, I think listen into it and have fun while Chris Parnell is telling you silly parts about the story. But if you're just going mm-hmm. around trying to collect, you know, the 30 underground signposts, just put on
the podcast. It is Shark Week. It is Shark Week. So maybe, true. You know, observe Shark Week in a good way, you know,
and be a shark.
Yeah. And you could play the truth seeking adventure in August, I guess.
There also will be like a little bit of a demo, I think, for the DLC. So, you know, cool. Go check that out. But in addition to that, whether you're playing Maneater or something else, I do want to talk a little bit about what we've been playing, especially because I know you guys have been jumping into a bit of a storied franchise that we've talked about on the show before. But Brian, I'll start with you. What have you been playing?
Yeah, so they had a sort of deep sale after E3 or whatever E3 was this year, where, you know, we got more information about Far Cry 6. And I did an interview with the sort of like lead writer and the sort of lead sort of creative gameplay designer. And it before when we were getting warmed up, because we're working from home, everything is like a million technical moving parts. We just started sort of reminiscing about the Far Cry franchise. And I just had one of those things click in my head where I was like, this is such an incredibly important franchise to me. It's always been so near and dear to my heart, but it's not really something I associate with, like, you know, you go like, oh, I really love like The Legend of Zelda, or I love The Last of Us games. You know, there's this like, you know, large narrative that, you know, connects so many of these things, and they've been special to me because the Far Cry games are very similar, but also largely disparate in terms of their settings and tones in a lot of ways. But I noticed that like they put a bunch of the games up super cheap. So I went back and I bought Far Cry 1, 2, 3, 4, and Blood Dragon. And I think I got all five of those games for like 18, 20 bucks total. So they're super cheap. Sorry if you missed the sale. They regularly go on sale though. And I just went back and started like tracing the roots of this series, which is something I've been trying to do a little more of with things I love, is sort of figure out like, where did this start? How did it evolve? And I think there was a lot of sort of notion that this is a sort of stale and repetitive franchise. And I would say in a lot of ways it is, but not really more so than the average video game series that gets annualized. And I think a lot of those get a free pass. And I feel like this is like a sort of like, it's weird to say this about a franchise that, you know, routinely sells fairly well. It's fairly critically acclaimed, but I feel like Far Cry is kind of slept on. Like, I feel like people don't really celebrate this series in the way they do a lot of other big ones. And watching it grow and evolve over the years, going from the first Far Cry, which is very sort of straightforward, you don't have a ton of wiggle room in terms of your creativity, but also like famously for the time, it was mostly outdoors. Right. Which is in an era of like sort of corridor driven first person shooters that were dark and strange. And Far Cry 1 has a lot of that, too, including weird mutants that you have to fight, which I totally forgot about. Going into like a large tropical setting and giving people, you know, hang gliders and all these different weapons and zip lines and stuff like that was really clever and really cool. And then moving on to Far Cry 2, which I think like suffers a lot from being the kind of the sepia toned, murky brown looking games of the era, that, you know, your early Gears of War, your Resident Evil 5s. That's when it started to move open world. But 3 is when it really sort of just like kicked off, right? Like 3, it hit its stride, almost sort of perfected the formula that we see today. But it got me a chance to jump back into 4, which is a game I believe I 100%ed when it first came out. You know, Troy Baker plays Pagan Min. It takes place in Karat. It's got sort of these gigantic mountains, but also rivers. It's got, you know, tigers and elephants that you can ride, bulls. There's all sorts of like bizarre, crazy animals in it. And it does some of the, like, my favorite stuff an open world game can do. I think it totally does that. Like, the thing that Far Cry's always struggled with is, how do we tell a serious story but also get a bunch of goofy nonsense in here? And I think 5 dropped the ball in a lot of ways. The setting was kind of boring and stuff like that. But it all just got me so damn excited for Far Cry 6, which is coming out later this year. And I feel like this is, like, going to really bring the series back to where I want it to be. And I can't wait for it, personally. Like, so yeah, Far Cry rules.
Well said, Brian. Yeah, I jumped into 1 and 2. I played 2, I don't know, a million years ago. It was like one of the, you know, I had like kind of a lapse period in gaming through college. And then that was one of the games that I kind of picked up and got me back into it. And it was just, you know, I was blown away about how cool it looked and how like the what is it, the procedurally generated fire that will just occasionally work how you want it to, and other times it won't at all. But yeah, Far Cry 3 is one of my favorite games ever. And it's, it, you know, you said it well, like it, that game is, or that series, I think it's written off a lot as, you know, just being another annualized Ubisoft thing. But like the problem that with 3 is how much it completely like threw that formula in the air and how many systems it introduced that have since been kind of like done to death by other Ubisoft games. But the whole idea of like, oh, go to this area, climb the watchtower, unlock the thing around here, sneak into the outpost. You can go loud or you can go quiet. And then, you know, I mean, it, I feel like it's a very rock solid foundation to the point that since then it's almost been like it was very sporadically like it evolved very like kind of all over the place. Like the first game to the second game to the third game, they were still kind of like figuring out what worked and what didn't. And then the jump from the third to the fourth is like you added bees and elephants. You know, there's like not a ton of new stuff in there. I never loved the setting for 4. Like it's a really fun game, but for whatever reason, it just didn't gel with me. But I'm extremely excited for 6 too. I think it's, I have this weird thing. I don't know what makes me like this. I like games on islands. There's something I like about that. Like it, I think there's that inherent frustration of being like, what do you mean I can't go any further? But with an island, I'm like, that makes sense. Islands are like that sometimes. I'll forgive it.
You know the limit. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Well, I love Link's Awakening, honestly. Like exactly. This is, you know, there's a finite set of tiles you can walk on here.
There's something just wonderfully self-contained about that. And also, I don't know, it compels you to go inward as opposed to outward, which is, I don't know, it's a whole thing. But
I as someone who I think dips in and out of the franchise and hasn't played it nearly to the extent that both of you have, at least from like somewhat of an outside perspective, I feel like part of why it maybe feels like it flies under the radar, sort of like Brian, to your point, is that after 3, because 3 was like such the acclaimed hit, it felt like, at least in the marketing, every game after was trying to tell you how it was like 3, for better and worse. And so it was like, here's the villain who is like Voss but isn't Voss. Here is the, you know, the lush outdoor setting that will be part of it. Here is the political but not political story that's at the heart of it. I feel like it got buried under a lot of the like, how does it compare to 3 conversations often, which is often what kept me away from like, oh, I heard 4 wasn't as good as 3 and it has a lot in common. So I just skipped 4. I'm sure there are great parts of it. Like you were saying, you've enjoyed your visit back to it, but it was just something like, oh, I heard it's like 3. Okay, I'll move on. Oh, 5 kind of muddies the water with its story. Okay, I'll move on.
Right.
I think maybe people like this for this reason, but I feel like this is not the primary selling point. Like this is obviously the sexiest part of it to be like, we've got this incredibly well-written villain and it's all very, you know, edgy and it's like kind of, you know, it's mature storytelling. And like, you can see they're continuing this. They got, you know, Giancarlo Esposito playing the villain in the new one, which is great, but that's not why I play Far Cry, you know? Yeah. Like I play Far Cry because I want to like trick a wild boar into biting someone, which is funny to me, and then I will ride away on a stolen Jeep which is on fire. Like that level of like kind of emergent gameplay craziness is like really that's what it does so well. But it's also that's I think a lot harder to market without just seeming like you're just throwing a bunch of shit and seeing what sticks.
I think what 4 does in terms of what you're talking about is really interesting, and in that Troy Baker's Pagan Min is sort of consistently more annoyed with your actions. And he will radio in to you and to be like, you just blew up my base, you son of a bitch, and I'm gonna come kill you and something like that. I think that's a good way to do it, is sort of just like marry your actions with this kind of subtext of like, all right, I just went on this massive, crazy killing spree. I threw bait into the middle of this base camp and a tiger attacked everybody, and then I got in this crappy little duct tape helicopter and flew away, and it went like, and I'm throwing bombs on people and stuff like that, blowing up his convoys, and then he calls in to be like, why did you do that to me? I hate you. I'm gonna kill you. That, I think that's an interesting way to do it. But I feel like the Joseph Sneed stuff they did in the next one, I feel like 5 was such a weird step back. It also, it's a franchise with all these bizarre diagonals. Like Blood Dragon works really well because it's totally assertive in how completely insane it is, and it's also 3 to 5 hours long. Whereas Far Cry Primal felt like an interesting experiment and a nice deviation from the norm, and I was sort of I'm kind of impressed at the way they were able to find parallels to make like sort of, you know, Fred Flintstone versions of all of the contemporary Far Cry tropes. But then there's also all these weird DLCs they do, from like the Valley of the Yeti to like the weird Vietnam War stuff. And a lot of it just is all over the place. It doesn't mesh. But then underneath all that, there's like this custom, you know, create a game mode where some fans like recently built the entirety of GoldenEye. Like, it's just, it's so crazy. And I just feel like there's so much here that's cool, but it's so all over the place, but also samey, that it doesn't really have its place in like the, you know, the video game Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't have like memorable, I mean, it has memorable characters. It doesn't have a memorable like universe, because it's each game is, as the namesake, like it is a far cry from the last one. Like, it's always it's always a crazy different new place that has a lot of, you know, It's a wacky setting. It's a, you know, it's a virtual tourism in a sense where you can do whatever you want. But you know, it's that double-edged sword of like, I personally, I don't know. I always hate the Abstergo, you know, Illuminati stuff in Assassin's Creed. Like, cause if you jump into one of them and you haven't been keeping track of what's going on, you're like, what did I miss? Who are these normal, regular humans in like polar fleece vests who I have to play as for a while? And I'm like, I just assume be like, give me a game where you're a Viking or an Egyptian guy or a ninja or whatever, like whatever. Like, let me, you know, I'm down with like the, like, I know what an Assassin's Creed game is. I'm happy to jump into it. And I appreciate that Far Cry is all kind of, it's doing its own thing. Like, every game is encapsulated. And obviously there's like returning, you know, side characters and familiar themes and things you have to climb to unlock areas of the map. But like, it's, I think because it isn't, you know, it doesn't have this like serialized through line, that there's not like a pressure for people to stay up to date with what's happening in that universe. I don't know. It's maybe that's sort of the appeal to me, is that there's a sense of discovery there, because every game is a new thing to a certain degree. Even if some of the mechanics are familiar, it's more like, what is this place? What's going on here?
Yeah, I think they live and thrive on their settings, right?
Yeah.
And you do get that shit. Like, as I was saying, I jump in and out, and like when I jump in, I love it. Like, I have a blast. Even going to your point, Brian, like I weirdly admired the bit of Primal that I played for its attempts at like putting modern ideas and conceits into the idea of riding a woolly mammoth and beating someone over the head with a bone club. Like, it tried its best, but yeah, there are times where I think the scattershot nature of it also does make it feel like a franchise that, if I miss it for a couple of years, it's fine. But when I do play it, I love it and play for, you know, 30, 40 hours and have a blast with it. I'm excited for 6. Like, as of right now, I think the setting can lend itself to a lot of great possibilities. It seems like, as we're all saying, like, it being on an island, I'll have like a general sense of the space of it, which I really appreciate. Giancarlo being in the game is definitely not a bad side to it. Chorizo the dog looks adorable, but it's one of those things where the DLC that's going to bring back all the villains, like, I don't really care about, like, that's the season pass.
Yeah, that's like familiar acid trip stuff, which is like, again, it's sort of okay, that's not what I just signed up for.
Yeah. But like, I get it to a certain extent, because the villains are the things people know about this franchise, and that also allows them to plan ahead for what the season pass is. Like, people may love parts of Far Cry 6 and maybe they'll pivot and do some DLC around it, but they can't account for that. They do know people love Voss and Pig and Min and Joseph Seed, at least like as like touch points for those games. People know what they relate to, and so it's easy to
Blood Dragon is like a singular thing, and I was totally expecting that to become annualized or repeated in the way that so many, you know, Ubisoft things are. But to have like a short standalone Far Cry game built in the same engine, we've gotten, you know, we've got like the Valley of the Yetis, we've gotten the weird sort of Far Cry 5 spinoff stuff, and now the thing with New Dawn, villains. Yeah. But it's never, New Dawn was kind of that, but that was, I mean, that was trying out a whole like,
it was like almost a literal repaint of
it. It was a weird call. And like, the thing that made, I don't know, I love Blood Dragon so much because it didn't take itself seriously and it didn't overstay its welcome. Like, it was such a bizarre little, you know, experiment. And I was almost like, what does this look like if you try it? What are there different flavored versions of this? Like, what if you do, you know, you do like a medieval version? Like, because that one did the sort of neo-futuristic vaporwave.
That sounds amazing,
right? Like, that'd be wacky. Like, and I mean, we got Kate Sinclair. Yeah,
right? If Primal was a 5-hour thing, kind of like Blood Dragon,
yeah,
it would be more fondly remembered.
And it's bittersweet because like I liked Primal to a certain degree. I thought it did some really interesting stuff, but it also, I don't think I finished it because I didn't care. There's just like cavemen yelling at me and with subtitled caveman language, and I was like, okay, that's cool. I got a bow and arrow. This is fine. And it was, you know, I guess at that point there was definitely sort of like franchise fatigue, because like 3 was amazing, blew me away. The Blood Dragon, more of the same, but completely kind of reimagined and shaken up enough that it was interesting. And also it was short. It's like 5 hours long. And then 4 came along and it was so much of the same with like little tweaks. It was like, you know, very familiar. And then by the time Primal rolled out, I was like, I'm good. You know?
Yeah.
One thing about 5 is like, I feel like it didn't really gel with any of us. And it's like, it's definitely well made. I think a lot of that comes from the fact that we live in America, and like the marketing was very much hinging on sort of like some American politics that maybe don't really gel with everybody. But it's also like, if you live in, I don't know, if you live in France, like that's probably like a crazy exotic location to go to. But if you live in Nepal, like playing Far Cry 4 is probably like the same thing where you're like, okay, like I guess like I'll mm-hmm. go climb a fake mountain that it looks like ones we have here.
Also the timing of 5 just in relation to where our country then went in the preceding years.
Yeah, like, that was,
if you need an escape from politics, Far Cry 5 was not the best place to go.
Right. And yeah. I've said this before, but like there was a lot of conversation around 5 that sort of being like this skewering of Trump Republicans, but Far Cry 5 is one of the most sort of like overtly, you know, gun proud games I've ever played. Like you run around with an assault rifle that has an American flag on it, and it's a blast. You know, like it's like, no pun intended. Like I think that game sort of celebrates a lot of the stuff that I think a lot of like sort of more liberal people were expecting it to skewer. My issue with 5 is that when I go to these games, I want all of the sort of systems to be completely insane, and not necessarily in familiarity. But when we were doing press interviews for 5, and I brought this up with the people I interviewed the other day, I was like, I asked you guys a couple of years ago, like this game takes place in Montana. Famously, that's where there's tons of dinosaur bones. Like, will there be dinosaurs in this game? And they're like, we actually got that very stupid question a lot, because I think a lot of people were just like, so you have what, cows and like turkeys? Like this is boring. Like what I love about 4 is that there are so many different animals in that game. It's insane. There's honey badgers and goats, and there's monkeys, and there's
I hope we get a Florida one. I feel like Florida is just going to be like floor cry. It's just going to be like,
oh my God.
Just, yeah. I mean, yeah, got all the animals. Gotcha. You need fan boats, I think. Do we have fan boats for that? I can't even remember.
There should be. Yeah, I feel like fan boats are in 3, and then you can put fan boats easily enough. Floor cry, as you. God, that's going to just be the name for it now. Anyway, it is also interesting. We are getting, just because we were going back to talking a little bit about like, do people feel like they're connected to this world and this universe? We are getting a Netflix anime for Far Cry, as well as a Blood Dragon like 6-episode anime.
About that.
I think
they made a Blood Dragon Trials game too.
Oh right, which yeah.
We always forget about.
it's such a strange franchise in terms of as you were saying, Brian. Like it feels like it can be all over the place, and that's perhaps why it does go under the radar. But when it's really fun, it is really really fun and engaging, and is sort of the prototypical thing we think about for a lot of these Ubisoft open world ideas. So I'm excited for 6, like especially. If we see some other open world games like Horizon Forbidden West, perhaps not come out in 2021, I feel like I'm going to be spending a lot of time hanging out with Giancarlo and just seeing what that world's up to. But I'm glad you've both been sort of in revisiting the franchise, still finding the stuff that you love about it so much and it bringing back those memories. Cause I'm really looking forward to 6.
Yeah. Sure. Thanks for giving us a place to yell about it.
Of course. What is the show if not a place to yell about things? And any other games briefly that either of you have been playing that you want to touch on?
I jump back into Hitman, and I love that game so much. I love it. There was one mission that I hadn't done. Like I played through 3, fell in love, bought the other two games, went through, played all of them. And I think it's the last, maybe the last mission in 2 or 1. I don't know. It's a resort. It's on an island. There you go. And it's interesting because for whatever reason, the way it starts you out, it's like kind of I had a really hard time with it. And I think it like starts you off with like less access to weapons or crap or something. And I was like bashing my head against one particular route. And I just eventually didn't rage quit. I was just like, man. And then like walked away. Didn't touch it for a while. And I jumped back into it. And I was like, there's a whole part of this I didn't check out. And I went like creeping around in some bushes and then just messed up this server farm and then poisoned a bunch of people with like vomit gas. And just, I love that game. And I'm so excited for whatever they do with James Bond. I really hope it's like just even slightly on par with Hitman. Cause this series is just, oh God, it's so good. I've been occasionally jumping in to do the elusive targets, which are like the, you know, limited time. You only get one shot. It's now or never. Mom spaghetti on your sweater, whatever. Kind of just, you got it. You got to do it. Like get this one person. If you screw up, it's gone forever. And the most recent one was a pair of twins, but you could only kill one of them. And if you hurt the other one, you were in big trouble. And I was like, oh boy, I got to find this needle in a haystack. I got to track these guys down. They're creeping around this, you know, pastoral Italian beach town. I'm going to track it. And I go around the first corner and they're just like standing there taking a sightseeing tour or something. And I was like, oh, well, that was easy. And then I like a weird pervert just like crept around by their bottoms and was like looking at their wrist, because one of them has a gold wristwatch and the other doesn't. I was like, I gotta find the guy with the watch. And I'm like, they didn't care. Like, they were completely unfazed. And I was so used to, like, I don't know, killing high profile targets who are just like, if you go anywhere near them, they're like 18 guards are like, get them. But these guys were just walking around and I'm just like, I basically just walked up right next to them and then it's like shot one of the guards and tried to shoot him, missed. The other guard starts shooting at me. I just shoot the guy in the head and just take off running and then get in like one of those little Mr. Bean cars and then drive off. And it was like, you did the mission in like 3.5 minutes. You get no stars. You're an idiot. And I was like, well, I can't do that again.
Key, one of the funniest video game franchises. I don't think I really realized that until the new one came out.
It's so funny.
But yeah. It is so, like, I think you can play this game perfectly and meticulously and just be a hitman, right? But also there's like there, and even before you get in like the clown costumes and dressing like a complete buffoon, like there is so much stuff you can do in this game that just makes me laugh so hard. Every now and then I get so incredibly excited. You just mentioned it, that this team is working on a James Bond game. Like, that is so awesome. I keep forgetting that's happening. Between that and like Bethesda making an Indiana Jones game, it's kind of like, okay, that's two big projects to be really excited about.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of, you go ahead, Max.
I was going to say, like, I hope that they keep the sort of sleek and very stylish design of the newer Bond movies, but have some of the sensibilities of like the older Roger Moore ones. Because if you wind up with like completely wingnut nonsense gadgets, like, which you do, you get exploding rubber ducks and stuff like that in this game. But at the same time, it looks all just like hyper stylized and just like, oh yeah, like this is a cool guy who has sex, but also he's got a jetpack in his briefcase. Yeah.
Like, yeah, very dumb. That's exactly what I was going to say. It was just like it, talking to the idea of like, you can play these games, the Hitman games, super meticulously and be the best hitman in the world. And you can also do it like an utter buffoon and still win, like piling bodies in a bathroom like that. Like, there's so much variety there. And I think that does speak to Bond across the ages of like, you can get this more serious side of it. And also the wackier side where it's, as you're saying, like jetpacks and jet skis and the moon. And like, you can just go to such crazy heights. I feel like they can find that balance really well. And like, I think back to older Bond games. I actually like never played GoldenEye growing up, but Nightfire was a really big touch point for me.
Right.
And like, I think about how those were very, you know, like first person shooter cinematic campaign games. And like, yes, there's a place for those with Bond, but I really want them to lean in the direction of a Hitman game. Like, I want them to do what they do well. And I feel like that's the reason you go to them for a Bond game.
Right. I mean, one of the first things that happens in GoldenEye, the movie, which was recreated in the game, is that James Bond pops into out of a vent and kills a guy in a toilet. Like, that's funny. If you don't think that's funny, I don't know what to tell you. Like, that's killing a guy in a toilet in a suit, full suit, is funny. And like, they put that in the game. And I feel like there's like this, you know, there's a comedy element to James Bond that's always been there. And just like it's there for Hitman, it is such a perfect marriage of IP and developer. I can't wait to see what they're doing with this.
My whole thing is, if you had Agent 47 like literally just say the names of the achievements or the challenges out loud after doing them, you've got a James Bond game.
Yeah,
because he's like, you know, there's one where it's like if you take a, I don't know, it's like if you poison a hot sauce shot or something, or you just take a shot of hot sauce, it's like 47 on the Scoville scale or something. It's like, which is just so corny, and I love
it. It's got that Peter Parker thing, right? Where he's got like the goofy one-liners.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's such a great balance. I need to go back to that one. That's just one of those things where it's like, you can get lost in a level, especially if you're bad at it. Like, you can get lost and just be in a level for hours, which is really fun.
Yeah.
But it's like a thing I kind of feel like you need to give a lot of time.
It's also super duper forgiving with saves coming. Which is totally cheap as hell. But basically, if you save before you try something completely stupid and you actually pull it off, you'll get the achievement or whatever, you get the challenges. And then if you reload it, I think it basically, like, you can basically, I think you can kill a dude like four times over and on the same save, sort of. It's a whole weird thing, but like, it's the thing that really worked for me is basically leaning into my failures and being like, not trying to play it super, super well and stealthy, but was kind of like, okay, I'm going to go in here like kind of a klutz, going to be more of like a Mr. Bean than a Mr. Bond, you know, let's do this properly.
It lets you do both of those. And yeah, it's such a great example of what they're able to accomplish. I can't wait to see what they do next with Bond, but yeah, I keep forgetting Hitman was like a game that came out this year and is one of my favorites. But yeah, it's a really great time. I need to go revisit that this summer. But anything else you guys have been playing before we wrap up that you want to give a shout to?
Nothing off the top of my head.
Wolfenstein.
Well, our audience won't care, but I'm ready to give Skyward Sword another chance this weekend.
I am too. I keep forgetting that's this weekend. I definitely am excited to do that as well. I have just been continuing. I've not been great at sticking to anything, so I've just been playing some embargoed stuff I can't talk about. Nothing huge, but just some fun stuff we can talk about in later weeks. And then just continuing my Fortnite and Personaing. Just really not been able to like stick into anything too much deeper than that. Mm-hmm. But we'll have plenty to talk about as more games release as we get into the fall. August, as we mentioned, we'll have Ghost of Tsushima and Kena: Bridge of Spirits. So it's actually going to be a bit of a busy month for PlayStation before the fall rush hits. But that's going to pretty much wrap us up for this week's episode of Podcast Beyond. Brian and Max, anything you want to plug this week?
God, it's been busy. I helped Relic and Sega announce Company Heroes 3 yesterday. We did a whole presentation for that. That was fun. I interviewed Suda51 yesterday. That's going to go up soon. And then I did a big piece on Metroid that we're publishing, I believe, tomorrow. So keep an eye out for that.
It's tomorrow too. Yeah.
I've been doing the weekly Cannon Fodder series, which Jesse Gill writes and produced, and then he has me go in and I add a bunch of dumb jokes, and we have a ton of fun with that show. And it's just like, we've been doing it for every episode of Loki. We did one for Black Widow. I don't know what happens next, but we'll be doing one for that as well. And if you've been, I don't know if you've been keeping track of these shows and just want the sort of dorky color commentary and all the weird background details, that is the show to go watch.
Yeah. I've been really enjoying them, especially as like a very tightly produced, like, here's the recap if you need it, and here is the Easter egg and supplementary stuff you guys have been doing.
Yeah, and if you don't watch those shows and you want to pretend that you do, that's also a great loophole, because we spoil everything and then we do it real fast, and then you can act smart with your friends even without spending $30 on Disney Premier Plus Platinum Sapphire Access or whatever it's called.
That's the full name. Yeah, no, you got it in one. I really love them, especially as I have definitely checked into some other Easter egg videos that are like an hour long, and I'm like, why am I here for an hour? I just want to know who that background thing was, and you guys get to it very well. It's very funny. They're really great, so definitely go check those out.
Do I have to diss my hour long Easter egg videos like that, man?
You know, I mean, I don't know how you find the time to do that on the side, to be honest, but you keep doing what you do.
If you guys want to see a great hour long Easter egg video, my mom hid all sorts of plastic eggs and Cadbury Delights in the backyard. I'm gonna go out, I'm gonna do a real time Easter egg hunt, I'm gonna see if I can find them all, and then I'm gonna come inside and eat them out of my pastel basket.
I did that with my kid on Easter this year, but I only bought 12 eggs, so I just kept following behind her, taking her out of the basket and hiding her again. It was, like, oh, is it these are how the devs extend the gameplay.
That's
it's like a you're roguelike Easter egg.
A producer would love you because you were being very cost conscious. That is.
It was like a really grindy mobile game.
Well, if any developers want to reach out to Brian for help on producing asset use in their follow up games, you know who to contact. But also, I do want to just put out a general, you're on your director's cut. Yeah, bring in Brian. I do want to just briefly mention, I had mentioned on Twitter just in the sort of fallout and kerfuffle of all the like PlayStation indies discussion and whatnot, and I do know some developers do listen to the show. If you have a game coming out in the future on PlayStation that you want to talk about to a PlayStation audience and people who love talking about games, feel free to write in to beyond@ign.com. I'd love to talk to some more indie developers on the show, have them on, talk about the games that they're making, why they're so cool, because there are so many different varied awesome indie games coming out, and would love to be able to put the spotlight where we can.
That sounds preferable to spending 45 minutes talking about whether or not Kojima likes the word director's cuts or whatever.
Hey, it was only 30-ish minutes. Anyway, thank you all so much for joining us for this week's episode of Podcast Beyond. Normally, we publish every Wednesday at 3 p.m. Pacific at beyond.ign.com. youtube.com/IGNBeyond and your favorite podcast services around the world, unless of course Sony surprises us with a Thursday State of Play, as they seem to like to do.
And we will be publishing a 3-hour version of this episode in September. We're adding race cars and ramps, so keep an eye out for that.
You can also look forward to my Easter egg breakdown of the show, including all of the games that all three of us leaked throughout this episode that you'll find out about in the future. But otherwise, you can find us all on Twitter. I'm at JM Dornbush. Brian is at Agent Bizzle, and Max is at Max Scoville. Thank you both so much for joining me for this episode. Thank you, as always, to Red, our producer, for making the show happen. And thank you, everyone out there listening and watching. We hope you're safe. We hope you're well. And as always, beyond.
Beyond.
Have you ever watched a futuristic sci-fi movie and wondered, but wait, could any of this really happen? And will I live long enough to see it? That's what our show Hypothetical is about. I'm Carrie Bechet, and on this podcast, we ask what-if questions about the future. Like, what if we could read minds? What if the world's digital data was erased all at once? What would happen if the Yellowstone supervolcano erupted? Then we explore that question two ways, through speculative science fiction and through dialogue with brilliant scientists. The result is a genre-bending narrative that's interwoven with real facts provided by literal geniuses. And spoiler alert, a lot of the science fiction out there, it's not nearly as far-fetched as you might think. Come time travel with me into the future on Hypothetical. New episodes on Tuesdays, available on all your favorite podcast apps. Just search Hypothetical. That's HYPERTHETICAL.